With no warning and no presentiments, he saw her leaving high mass on her husband's arm, besieged by the curiosity and flattery of her new world. The same ladies from fine families who at first had scorned and ridiculed her for being an upstart without a name went out of their way to make her feel like one of them, and she intoxicated them with her charm. She had assumed the condition of woman of the world to such perfection that Florentino Arisa needed a moment of reflection to recognize her. She was another person. The composure of an older woman, the high boots, the hat with the veil and the colored plume from some oriental bird, everything about her was distinctive and confident, as if it had been hers from birth. He found her more beautiful and youthful than ever, but more lost to him than she had ever been, although he did not understand why until he saw the curve of her belly under the silk tunic. She was in her sixth month of pregnancy. But what impressed him most was that she and her husband made an admirable couple, and both of them negotiated the world with so much fluidity that they seemed to float above the pitfalls of reality. Florentino Arisa did not feel either jealousy or rage, only great contempt for himself. He felt poor, ugly, inferior, and unworthy not only of her, but of any other woman on the face of the earth. So she had returned. She came back without any reason to repent of the sudden change she had made in her life. On the contrary, she had fewer and fewer such reasons, above all after surviving the difficulties of the early years, which was especially admirable in her case, for she had come to her wedding night still trailing clouds of innocence. She had begun to lose them during her journey through Cousin Ildebranda's province. In Valle Dupar, she realized at last why the roosters chased the hens. She witnessed the brutal ceremony of the burros. She watched the birth of calves. And she listened to her cousins talking with great naturalness about which couples in the family still made love and which ones had stopped, and when and why, even though they continued to live together. That was when she was initiated into solitary love, with the strange sensation of discovering something that her instincts had always known. First in bed, holding her breath so she would not give herself away in the bedroom she shared with half a dozen cousins, and then, with eagerness and unconcern, sprawling on the bathroom floor, her hair loose, smoking her first mule driver's cigarette. She always did it with certain pangs of conscience, which she could overcome only after she was married and always in absolute secrecy, although her cousins boasted to each other not only about the number of orgasms they had in one day, but even about their form and size. But despite those bewitching first rites, she was still burdened by the belief that the loss of virginity was a bloody sacrifice. So that her wedding, one of the most spectacular of the final years of the last century, was for her the prelude to horror. The anguish of the honeymoon affected her much more than the social uproar caused by her marriage to the most incomparably elegant young man of the day. When the banns were announced at high mass in the cathedral, Fermina Daza received anonymous letters again, some of them containing death threats. But she took scant notice of them because all the fear of which she was capable was centered on her imminent violation. Although that was not her intention, it was the correct way to respond to anonymous letters from a class accustomed by the affronts of history to bow before fait accompli. So that little by little, they swallowed their opposition as it became clear that the marriage was irrevocable. She noticed the gradual changes in the attention paid her by livid women, degraded by arthritis and resentment, who one day were convinced of the uselessness of their intrigues and appeared unannounced in the little park of the Evangels as if it were their own home, bearing recipes and engagement gifts. Tránsito Arisa knew that world, although this was the only time it caused her suffering in her own person, and she knew that her clients always reappeared on the eve of great parties to ask her please to dig down into her jars and lend them their pawned jewels for only 24 hours, in exchange for the payment of additional interest. It had been a long while since this had occurred to the extent it did now. The jars emptied, so that the ladies with long last names could emerge from their shadowy sanctuaries and, radiant in their own borrowed jewels, appear at a wedding more splendid than any that would be seen for the rest of the century, and whose ultimate glory was the sponsorship of Dr. Rafael Núñez, 3 times President of the Republic, philosopher, poet, and author of the words to the national anthem, as anyone could learn from that time on in some of the more recent dictionaries. Fermina Daza came to the main altar of the cathedral on the arm of her father, whose formal dress lent him, for the day, an ambiguous air of respectability. She was married forever after at the main altar of the cathedral, with a mass at which 3 bishops officiated, at 11 o'clock in the morning on the day of the Holy Trinity, and without a single charitable thought for Florentino Ariza, who at that hour was delirious with fever, dying because of her, lying without shelter on a boat that was not to carry him to forgetting. During the ceremony and later at the reception, she wore a smile that seemed painted on with white lead, a soulless grimace that some interpreted as a mocking smile of victory, but in reality was her poor attempt at disguising the terror of a virgin bride. It was fortunate that unforeseen circumstances, combined with her husband's understanding, resolved the first 3 nights without pain. It was providential. The ship of the Compagnie Générale Transatlantique, its itinerary upset by bad weather in the Caribbean, announced only 3 days in advance that its departure had been moved ahead by 24 hours, so that it would not set sail for La Rochelle on the day following the wedding, as had been planned for the past 6 months, but on that same night. No one believed that the change was not another of the many elegant surprises the wedding had to offer, for the reception ended after midnight on board the brightly lit ocean liner, with a Viennese orchestra that was premiering the most recent waltzes by Johann Strauss on this voyage, so that the various members of the wedding party, soggy with champagne, had to be dragged ashore by their long-suffering wives when they began to ask the stewards if there were any free cabins so they could continue the celebration all the way to Paris. The last to leave saw Lorenzo Daza outside the port taverns, sitting on the ground in the middle of the street, his tuxedo in ruins. He was crying with tremendous loud wails, the way Arabs cry for their dead, sitting in a trickle of fouled water that might well have been a pool of tears. Not on the first night on rough seas, or on the following nights of smooth sailing, or ever in her very long married life, did the barbarous acts occur that Fermina Daza had feared. Despite the size of the ship and the luxuries of their stateroom, the first night was a horrible repetition of the schooner trip from Riohacha, and her husband, a diligent physician, did not sleep at all so he could comfort her, which was all that an overly distinguished physician knew how to do for seasickness. But the storm abated on the 3rd day, after the port of Guayra, and by that time they had spent so much time together and had talked so much that they felt like old friends. On the 4th night, when both resumed their ordinary habits, Dr. Juvenal Urbino was surprised that his young wife did not pray before going to sleep. She was frank with him. The duplicity of the nuns had provoked in her a certain resistance to rituals, but her faith was intact, and she had learned to maintain it in silence. She said, "I prefer direct communication with God." He understood her reasoning, and from then on they each practiced the same religion in their own way. They had had a brief engagement, but a rather informal one for that time. Dr. Urbino had visited her in her house, without a chaperone, every day at sunset. She would not have permitted him to touch even her fingertips before the Episcopal blessing, but he had not attempted to. It was on the first calm night, when they were in bed but still dressed, that he began his first caresses with so much care that his suggestion that she put on her nightdress seemed natural to her. She went into the bathroom to change, but first she turned out the lights in the stateroom, and when she came out in her chemise, she covered the cracks around the door with articles of clothing so she could return to bed in absolute darkness. As she did so, she said with good humor, What do you expect, Doctor? This is the first time I have slept with a stranger. Dr. Urbino felt her slide in next to him like a startled little animal, trying to keep as far away as possible, in a bunk where it was difficult for two people to be together without touching. He took her hand, cold and twitching with terror. He entwined his fingers with hers. And almost in a whisper, he began to recount his recollections of other ocean voyages. She was tense again because when she came back to bed, she realized that he had taken off all his clothes while she was in the bathroom, which revived her terror of what was to come. But what was to come took several hours, for Dr. Urbino continued talking very slowly as he won her body's confidence, millimeter by millimeter. He spoke to her of Paris, of love in Paris, of the lovers in Paris who kissed on the street, on the omnibus, on the flowering terraces of the cafes open to the burning winds and languid accordions of summer, who made love standing up on the quays of the Seine without anyone disturbing them. As he spoke in the darkness, he caressed the curve of her neck with his fingertips. He caressed the fine silky hair on her arms, her evasive belly. And when he felt that her tension had given way, he made his first attempt to raise her nightgown. But she stopped him with an impulse typical of her character. She said, "I know how to do it myself." She took it off, in fact, and then she was so still that Dr. Urbino might have thought she was no longer there if it had not been for the glint of her body in the darkness. After a while, he took her hand again, and this time it was warm and relaxed, but still moist with a tender dew. They were silent and unmoving for a while longer, he looking for the opportunity to take the next step, and she waiting for it without knowing where it would come from, while the darkness expanded as their breathing grew more and more intense. Without warning, he let go of her hand and made his leap into the void. He wet the tip of his forefinger with his tongue and grazed her nipple when it was caught off guard, and she felt a mortal explosion as if he had touched a raw nerve. She was glad of the darkness so he could not see the searing blush that shook her all the way to the base of her skull. "Don't worry," he said with great calm. "Don't forget that I've met them already." He felt her smile, and her voice was sweet and new in the darkness. "I remember it very well," she said, "and I'm still angry." Then he knew that they had rounded the Cape of Good Hope, and he took her large, soft hand again and covered it with forlorn little kisses. First the hard metacarpus, the long, discerning fingers, the diaphanous nails, and then the hieroglyphics of her destiny on her perspiring palm. She never knew how her hand came to his chest and felt something it could not decipher. He said, "It is a scapular." She caressed the hairs on his chest one by one, and then seized all the hair in her fist to pull it out by the roots. "Harder," he said. She tried, until she knew she was not hurting him, and then it was her hand that sought his, lost in the darkness. But he did not allow their fingers to intertwine. Instead, he grasped her by the wrist and moved her hand along his body with an invisible but well-directed strength until she felt the ardent breath of a naked animal without bodily form, but eager and erect. Contrary to what he had imagined, even contrary to what she herself had imagined, she did not withdraw her hand or let it lie inert where he placed it, but instead, she commended herself, body and soul, to the Blessed Virgin, clenched her teeth for fear she would laugh out loud at her own madness, and began to identify her rearing adversary by touch, discovering its size, the strength of its shaft, the extension of its wings, amazed by its determination, but pitying its solitude, making it her own with a detailed curiosity that someone less experienced than her husband might have confused with caresses. He summoned all his reserves of strength to overcome the vertigo of her implacable scrutiny, until she released it with childish unconcern as if she were tossing it into the trash. "I have never been able to understand how that thing works," she said. Then, with authoritative methodology, he explained it to her in all seriousness while he moved her hand to the places he mentioned, and she allowed it to be moved with the obedience of an exemplary pupil. At a propitious moment, he suggested that all of this was easier in the light. He was going to turn it on, but she held his arm, saying, "I see better with my hands." In reality, she wanted to turn on the light as well, but she wanted to be the one to do it, without anyone's ordering her to, and she had her way. Then he saw her in the sudden brightness, huddled in the fetal position beneath the sheet. But he watched as she grasped the animal understudy without hesitation, turned it this way and that, observed it with an interest that was beginning to seem more scientific, and said when she was finished, "How ugly it is. Even uglier than a woman's thing." He agreed, and pointed out other disadvantages, more serious than ugliness. He said, "It is like a firstborn son. You spend your life working for him, sacrificing everything for him, and at the moment of truth, he does just as he pleases." She continued to examine it, asking what this was for and what that was for, and when she felt satisfied with her information, she hefted it in both hands to confirm that it did not weigh enough to bother with, and let it drop with a gesture of disdain. "Besides, I think it has too many things on it," she said. He was astounded. The original thesis of his dissertation had been just that: the advantage of simplifying the human organism. It seemed antiquated to him, with many useless or duplicated functions that had been essential in other stages of the human race, but were not in ours. Yes, it could be more simple, and by the same token, less vulnerable. He concluded, "It is something that only God can do, of course, but in any event, it would be good to have it established in theoretical terms." She laughed with amusement and so much naturalness that he took advantage of the opportunity to embrace her and kiss her for the first time on the mouth. She responded, and he continued giving her very soft kisses on her cheeks, her nose, her eyelids, while he slipped his hand under the sheet and caressed her flat, straight pubic hair, the pubic hair of a Japanese. She did not move his hand away, but she kept hers on the alert in the event that he took one step further. "Let's not go on with the medical lesson," she said. "No," he said. "This is going to be a lesson in love." Then he pulled down the sheet, and she not only did not object, but kicked it away from the bunk with a rapid movement of her feet because she could no longer bear the heat. Her body was undulant and elastic, much more serious than it appeared when dressed, with its own scent of a forest animal, which distinguished her from all the other women in the world. Defenseless in the light, she felt a rush of blood surge up to her face, and the only way she could think of to hide it was to throw her arms around her husband's neck and give him a hard, thorough kiss that lasted until they were both gasping for breath. He was aware that he did not love her. He had married her because he liked her haughtiness, her seriousness, her strength, and also because of some vanity on his part. But as she kissed him for the first time, he was sure there would be no obstacle to their inventing true love. They did not speak of it that first night, when they spoke of everything until dawn, nor would they ever speak of it. But in the long run, neither of them had made a mistake. At dawn, when they fell asleep, she was still a virgin, but she would not be one much longer. The following night, in fact, after he taught her how to dance Viennese waltzes under the starry Caribbean sky, he went to the bathroom after she did. And when he returned to the stateroom, he found her waiting for him, naked in the bed. Then it was she who took the initiative, and gave herself without fear, without regret, with the joy of an adventure on the high seas, and with no traces of bloody ceremony except for the rose of honor on the sheet. They both made love well, almost as if by miracle. And they continued to make love well, night and day, and better each time for the rest of the voyage. And when they reached La Rochelle, they got along as if they were old lovers. They stayed in Europe, with Paris as their base, and made short trips to neighboring countries. During that time they made love every day, more than once on winter Sundays when they frolicked in bed until it was time for lunch. He was a man of strong impulses and well-disciplined besides, and she was not one to let anyone take advantage of her, so they had to be content with sharing power in bed. After 3 months of feverish lovemaking, he concluded that one of them was sterile, and they both submitted to rigorous examinations at the Hôpital de la Salpêtrière, where he had been an intern. It was an arduous but fruitless effort. However, when they least expected it, and with no scientific intervention, the miracle occurred. When they returned home, Fermina was in the 6th month of her pregnancy and thought herself the happiest woman on earth. The child they had both longed for was born without incident under the sign of Aquarius and baptized in honor of the grandfather who had died of cholera. It was impossible to know if it was Europe or love that changed them, for both occurred at the same time. They were, in essence, not only between themselves but with everyone else, just as Florentino Arisa perceived them when he saw them leaving Mass 2 weeks after their return on that Sunday of his misfortune. They came back with a new conception of life, bringing with them the latest trends in the world and ready to lead. He with the most recent developments in literature, music, and above all, in his science. He had a subscription to Le Figaro so he would not lose touch with reality, and another to the Revue des Deux Mondes so that he would not lose touch with poetry. He had also arranged with his bookseller in Paris to receive works by the most widely read authors, among them Anatole France and Pierre Loti, and by those he liked best, including Rémy de Gaumont and Paul Bourget, but under no circumstances anything by Émile Zola, whom he found intolerable despite his valiant intervention in the Dreyfus affair. The same bookseller agreed to mail him the most attractive scores from the Ricordi catalogue, chamber music above all, so that he could maintain the well-deserved title earned by his father as the greatest friend of concerts in the city. Fermina Vassa, always resistant to the demands of fashion, brought back 6 trunks of clothing from different periods, for the great labels did not convince her. She had been in the Tuileries in the middle of winter for the launching of the collection by Wirth, the indisputable tyrant of haute couture, and the only thing she got was a case of bronchitis that kept her in bed for 5 days. La Ferrière seemed less pretentious and voracious to her, but her wise decision was to buy her fill of what she liked best in the second-hand shops, although her husband swore in dismay that it was corpses' clothing. In the same way, she brought back quantities of Italian shoes without brand names, which she preferred to the renowned and famous shoes by Ferri. And she brought back a parasol from Dupuy, as red as the fires of hell, which gave our alarmed social chroniclers much to write about. She bought only 1 hat from Madame Rebaud, but on the other hand she filled a trunk with sprigs of artificial cherries, stalks of all the felt flowers she could find, branches of ostrich plumes, crests of peacocks, tail feathers of Asiatic roosters, entire pheasants, hummingbirds, and a countless variety of exotic birds preserved in mid-flight, mid-call, mid-agony. Everything that had been used in the past 20 years to change the appearance of hats. She brought back a collection of fans from countries all over the world, each one appropriate to a different occasion. She brought back a disturbing fragrance chosen from many at the perfume shop in the Bazaar de la Charité, before the spring winds leveled everything with ashes. But she used it only once, because she did not recognize herself in the new scent. She also brought back a cosmetic case that was the latest thing in seductiveness, and she took it to parties at a time when the simple act of checking one's makeup in public was considered indecent. They also brought back 3 indelible memories. The unprecedented opening of the Tales of Hoffmann in Paris. The terrifying blaze that destroyed almost all the gondolas off St. Mark's Square in Venice, which they witnessed with grieving hearts from the window of their hotel. And their fleeting glimpse of Oscar Wilde during the first snowfall in January. But amid these and so many other memories, Dr. Juvenal Urbino had one that he always regretted not sharing with his wife, for it came from his days as a bachelor student in Paris. It was the memory of Victor Hugo, who enjoyed an impassioned fame here that had nothing to do with his books, because someone said that he had said, although no one actually heard him say it, that our Constitution was meant for a nation not of men, but of angels. From that time on, special homage was paid to him, and most of our many compatriots who traveled to France went out of their way to see him. A half dozen students, among them Juvenal Urbino, stood guard for a time outside his residence on Avenue Hélot, and at the cafés where it was said he came without fail and never came, and at last they sent a written request for a private audience in the name of the Angels of the Constitution of Rio Negro. They never received a reply. One day, when Juvenal Urbino happened to be passing the Luxembourg Gardens, he saw him come out of the Senate with a young woman on his arm. He seemed very old. He walked with difficulty, his beard and hair were less brilliant than in his pictures, and he wore an overcoat that seemed to belong to a larger man. He did not want to ruin the memory with an impertinent greeting. He was satisfied with the almost unreal vision that he would keep for the rest of his life. When he returned to Paris as a married man, in a position to see him under more formal circumstances, Victor Hugo had already died. As a consolation, Juvenal Urbino and Fermina Daza brought back the shared memory of a snowy afternoon when they were intrigued by a crowd that defied the storm outside a small bookshop on the Boulevard des Capucines because Oscar Wilde was inside. When he came out at last, elegant indeed, but perhaps too conscious of being so, the group surrounded him, asking that he sign their books. Dr. Urbino had stopped just to watch him, but his impulsive wife wanted to cross the boulevard so that he could sign the only thing she thought appropriate, given the fact that she did not have a book. Her beautiful gazelle skin glove. Long, smooth, soft, the same color as her newlywed skin. She was sure that a man as refined as he would appreciate the gesture. But her husband objected with firmness, and when she tried to go despite his arguments, he did not feel he could survive the embarrassment. "If you cross that street," he said to her, "when you get back here, you will find me dead." It was something natural in her. Before she had been married a year, she moved through the world with the same assurance that had been hers as a little girl in the wilds of San Juan de la Cienega, as if she had been born with it. And she had a facility for dealing with strangers that left her husband dumbfounded, and a mysterious talent for making herself understood in Spanish with anyone, anywhere. "You have to know languages when you go to sell something," she said with mocking laughter. "But when you go to buy, everyone does what he must to understand you." It was difficult to imagine anyone who could have assimilated the daily life of Paris with so much speed and so much joy, and who learned to love her memory of it despite the eternal rain. Nevertheless, when she returned home, overwhelmed by so many experiences, tired of traveling, drowsy with her pregnancy, the first thing she was asked in the port was what she thought of the marvels of Europe, and she summed up many months of bliss with four words of Caribbean slang. "It's not so much." The day that Florentino Ariza saw Fermina Daza in the atrium of the cathedral, in the sixth month of her pregnancy, and in full command of her new condition as a woman of the world, he made a fierce decision to win fame and fortune in order to deserve her. He did not even stop to think about the obstacle of her being married, because at the same time he decided, as if it depended on himself alone, that Dr. Juvenal Urbino had to die. He did not know when or how, but he considered it an ineluctable event that he was resolved to wait for without impatience or violence, even till the end of time. He began at the beginning. He presented himself unannounced in the office of Uncle Leo XII, president of the board of directors and general manager of the River Company of the Caribbean, and expressed his willingness to yield to his plans. His uncle was angry with him because of the manner in which he had thrown away the good position of telegraph operator in Villa de Leyva, but he allowed himself to be swayed by his conviction that human beings are not born once and for all on the day their mothers give birth to them, but that life obliges them over and over again to give birth to themselves. Besides, his brother's widow had died the year before, still smarting from rancor but without any heirs. And so he gave the job to his errant nephew. It was a decision typical of Don Leo XII Loaysa. Inside the shell of a soulless merchant was hidden a genial lunatic, as willing to bring forth a spring of lemonade in the Guajira Desert as to flood a solemn funeral with weeping at his heartbreaking rendition of In Questa Tomba Oscura. His head was covered with curls, he had the lips of a fawn, and all he needed was a lyre and a laurel wreath to be the image of the incendiary Nero of Christian mythology. When he was not occupied with the administration of his decrepit vessels, still afloat out of sheer distraction on the part of fate, or with the problems of river navigation, which grew more and more critical every day, he devoted his free time to the enrichment of his lyric repertoire. He liked nothing better than to sing at funerals. He had the voice of a galley slave, untrained but capable of impressive registers. Someone had told him that Enrico Caruso could shatter a vase with the power of his voice, and he had spent years trying to imitate him, even with the window panes. His friends brought him the most delicate vases they had come across in their travels through the world, and they organized special parties so that he might at last achieve the culmination of his dream. He never succeeded. Still, in the depth of his thundering, there was a glimmer of tenderness that broke the hearts of his listeners as if they were the crystal vases of the great Caruso, and it was this that made him so revered at funerals. Except at one, when he thought it a good idea to sing When I Wake Up in Glory, a beautiful and moving funeral song from Louisiana, and he was told to be quiet by the priest, who could not understand that Protestant intrusion in his church. And so, between operatic encores and Neapolitan serenades, his creative talent and his invincible entrepreneurial spirit made him the hero of river navigation during the time of its greatest splendor. He had come from nothing, like his dead brothers, and all of them went as far as they wished, despite the stigma of being illegitimate children and, even worse, illegitimate children who had never been recognized. They were the cream of what in those days was called the shop-counter aristocracy, whose sanctuary was the commercial club. And yet, even when he had the resources to live like the Roman emperor he resembled, Uncle Leo XII lived in the old city because it was convenient to his business, in such an austere manner and in such a plain house that he could never shake off an unmerited reputation for miserliness. His only luxury was even simpler. A house by the sea, 2 leagues from his offices, furnished only with 6 handmade stools, a stand for earthenware jars, and a hammock on the terrace where he could lie down to think on Sundays. No one described him better than he did when someone accused him of being rich.
"No, not rich," he said. "I am a poor man with money, which is not the same thing."
His strange nature, which someone once praised in a speech as lucid dementia, allowed him to see in an instant what no one else ever saw in Florentino Ariza. From the day he came to his office to ask for work, with his doleful appearance and his 26 useless years behind him, he had tested him with the severity of a barracks training that could have broken the hardest man. But he did not intimidate him. What Uncle Leo XII never suspected was that his nephew's courage did not come from the need to survive or from a brute indifference inherited from his father, but from a driving need for love, which no obstacle in this world or the next could ever break. The worst years were the early ones, when he was appointed clerk to the board of directors, which seemed a position made to order for him. Lothario Tugut, Uncle Leo XII's old music teacher, was the one who advised him to give his nephew a writing job, because he was a voracious wholesale consumer of literature, although he preferred the worst to the best. Uncle Leo XII disregarded what he said concerning his nephew's bad taste in reading, for Lothario Tugut would also say of him that he had been his worst voice student, and still he could make even tombstones cry. In any case, the German was correct in regard to what he had thought about least, which was that Florentino Arisa wrote everything with so much passion that even official documents seemed to be about love. His bills of lading were rhymed, no matter how he tried to avoid it, and routine business letters had a lyrical spirit that diminished their authority. His uncle himself came to his office one day with a packet of correspondence that he had not dared put his name to, and he gave him his last chance to save his soul.
"If you cannot write a business letter, you will pick up the trash on the dock," he said.
Florentino Arisa accepted the challenge. He made a supreme effort to learn the mundane simplicity of mercantile prose, imitating models from notarial files with the same diligence he had once used for popular poets. This was the period when he spent his free time in the Arcade of the Scribes, helping unlettered lovers to write their scented love notes in order to unburden his heart of all the words of love that he could not use in customs reports. But at the end of 6 months, no matter how hard he twisted, he could not wring the neck of his die-hard swan. So that when Uncle Leo XII reproached him a second time, he admitted defeat, but with a certain haughtiness. "Love is the only thing that interests me," he said.
"The trouble," his uncle said to him, "is that without river navigation there is no love."
He kept his threat to have him pick up trash on the dock, but he gave him his word that he would promote him, step by step, up the ladder of faithful service until he found his place. And he did. No work could defeat him, no matter how hard or humiliating it was. No salary, no matter how miserable, could demoralize him. And he never lost his essential fearlessness when faced with the insolence of his superiors. But he was not an innocent either. Everyone who crossed his path suffered the consequences of the overwhelming determination, capable of anything, that lay behind his helpless appearance. Just as Uncle Leo XII had foreseen, and according to his desire that his nephew not be ignorant of any secret in the business, Florentino Arisa moved through every post during 30 years of dedication and tenacity in the face of every trial. He fulfilled all his duties with admirable skill, studying every thread in that mysterious warp that had so much to do with the offices of poetry, but he never won the honor he most desired, which was to write one, just one, acceptable business letter. Without intending to, without even knowing it, he demonstrated with his life that his father had been right when he repeated until his dying day that there was no one with more common sense, no stonecutter more obstinate, no manager more lucid or dangerous than a poet. That, at least, is what he was told by Uncle Leo XII, who talked to him about his father during moments of sentimental leisure, and created an image that resembled a dreamer more than it did a businessman. He told him that Pius V Loaysa used the offices for matters more pleasant than work, and that he always arranged to leave the house on Sundays, with the excuse that he had to meet or dispatch a boat. What is more, he had an old boiler installed in the warehouse patio, with a steam whistle that someone would sound with navigation signals in the event his wife became suspicious. According to his calculations, Uncle Leo XII was certain that Florentino Ariza had been conceived on a desk in some unlocked office on a hot Sunday afternoon. While from her house, his father's wife heard the farewells of a boat that never sailed. By the time she learned the truth, it was too late to accuse him of infamy, because her husband was already dead. She survived him by many years, destroyed by the bitterness of not having a child, and asking God in her prayers for the eternal damnation of his bastard son. The image of his father disturbed Florentino Ariza. His mother had spoken of him as a great man with no commercial vocation, who had at last gone into the river business because his older brother had been a very close collaborator of the German Commodore Johann B. Elbers, the father of river navigation. They were the illegitimate sons of the same mother, a cook by trade, who had them by different men, and all bore her surname and the name of a pope chosen at random from the calendar of saints' days, except for Uncle Leo XII, named after the pope in office when he was born. The man called Florentino was their maternal grandfather, so that the name had come down to the son of Tránsito Ariza after skipping over an entire generation of pontiffs. Florentino always kept a notebook in which his father wrote love poems, some of them inspired by Tránsito Ariza, its pages decorated with drawings of broken hearts. Two things surprised him. One was the character of his father's handwriting, identical to his own, although he had chosen his because it was the one he liked best of the many he saw in a manual. The other was finding a sentence that he thought he had composed, but that his father had written in the notebook long before he was born. "The only regret I will have in dying is if it is not for love." He had also seen the only two pictures of his father. One had been taken in Santa Fe when he was very young, the same age as Florentino Ariza when he saw the photograph for the first time. And in it, he was wearing an overcoat that made him look as if he were stuffed inside a bear, and he was leaning against a pedestal that supported the decapitated gaiters of a statue. The little boy beside him was Uncle Leo XII, wearing a ship captain's hat. In the other photograph, his father was with a group of soldiers in God knows which of so many wars, and he held the longest rifle, and his mustache had a gunpowder smell that wafted out of the picture. He was a liberal and a Mason, just like his brothers, and yet he wanted his son to go to the seminary. Florentino Ariza did not see the resemblance that people observed, but according to his uncle Leo XII, Pius V was also reprimanded for the lyricism of his documents. In any case, he did not resemble him in the pictures, or in his memories of him, or in the image transfigured by love that his mother painted, or in the one unpainted by his uncle Leo XII with his cruel wit. Nevertheless, Florentino Ariza discovered the resemblance many years later as he was combing his hair in front of the mirror. And only then did he understand that a man knows when he is growing old because he begins to look like his father. He had no memory of him on the street of windows. He thought he knew that at one time his father slept there, very early in his love affair with Tránsito Ariza, but that he did not visit her again after the birth of Florentino. For many years, the baptismal certificate was our only valid means of identification, and Florentino Ariza's, recorded in the parish church of Santiburtius, said only that he was the natural son of an unwed natural daughter called Tránsito Ariza. The name of his father did not appear on it, although Pius V took care of his son's needs in secret until the day he died. This social condition closed the doors of the seminary to Florentino Ariza, but he also escaped military service during the bloodiest period of our wars because he was the only son of an unmarried woman. Every Friday after school, he sat across from the offices of the River Company of the Caribbean, looking at pictures of animals in a book that was falling apart because he had looked at it so often. His father would walk into the building without looking at him, wearing the frock coats that Tránsito Ariza later had to alter for him, and with a face identical to that of St. John the Evangelist on the altars. When he came out, many hours later, he would make certain that no one saw him, not even his coachman, and he would give him money for the week's expenses. They did not speak, not only because his father made no effort to, but because he was terrified of him. One day, after he waited much longer than usual, his father gave him the coins and said,
"Take them and do not come back again."
It was the last time he saw him. But in time, he was to learn that Uncle Leo XII, who was some 10 years younger, continued to bring money to Tránsito Arisa and was the one who took care of her after Pius V died of an untreated colic without leaving anything in writing and without the time to make any provisions for his only child, a child of the streets. The drama of Florentino Arisa, while he was a clerk for the River Company of the Caribbean, was that he could not avoid lyricism because he was always thinking about Fermina Daza, and he had never learned to write without thinking about her. Later, when he was moved to other posts, he had so much love left over inside that he did not know what to do with it, and he offered it to unlettered lovers free of charge, writing their love missives for them in the arcade of the scribes. That is where he went after work. He would take off his frock coat with his circumspect gestures and hang it over the back of the chair. He would put on the cuffs so he would not dirty his shirt sleeves. He would unbutton his vest so he could think better. And sometimes, until very late at night, he would encourage the hopeless with letters of mad adoration. From time to time, he would be approached by a poor woman who had a problem with one of her children, a war veteran who persisted in demanding payment of his pension, someone who had been robbed and wanted to file a complaint with the government. But no matter how he tried, he could not satisfy them, because the only convincing document he could write was a love letter. He did not even ask his new clients any questions, because all he had to do was look at the whites of their eyes to know what their problem was. And he would write page after page of uncontrolled love, following the infallible formula of writing as he thought about Fermina Daza and nothing but Fermina Daza. After the first month, he had to establish a system of appointments made in advance so that he would not be swamped by yearning lovers. His most pleasant memory of that time was of a very timid young girl, almost a child, who trembled as she asked him to write an answer to an irresistible letter that she had just received, and that Florentino Arisa recognized as one he had written on the previous afternoon. He answered it in a different style, one that was in tune with the emotions and the age of the girl, and in a hand that also seemed to be hers, for he knew how to create a handwriting for every occasion, according to the character of each person. He wrote, imagining to himself what Fermina Daza would have said to him if she had loved him as much as that helpless child loved her suitor. 2 days later, of course, he had to write the boy's reply with the same hand, style, and kind of love that he had attributed to him in the first letter. And so it was that he became involved in a feverish correspondence with himself. Before a month had passed, each came to him separately to thank him for what he himself had proposed in the boy's letter and accepted with devotion in the girl's response. They were going to marry. Only when they had their first child did they realize, after a casual conversation, that their letters had been written by the same scribe. And for the first time, they went together to the arcade to ask him to be the child's godfather. Florentino Arisa was so enraptured by the practical evidence of his dreams that he used time he did not have to write a lover's companion that was more poetic and extensive than the one sold in doorways for 20 centavos and that half the city knew by heart. He categorized all the imaginable situations in which he and Fermina Daza might find themselves, and for all of them he wrote as many models and alternatives as he could think of. When he finished, he had some 1,000 letters in 3 volumes as complete as the Covarrubias dictionary. But no printer in the city would take the risk of publishing them. And they ended up in an attic along with other papers from the past, for Tránsito Arisa flatly refused to dig out the earthenware jars and squander the savings of a lifetime on a mad publishing venture. Years later, when Florentino Arisa had the resources to publish the book himself, it was difficult for him to accept the reality that love letters had gone out of fashion. As he was starting out in the River Company of the Caribbean and writing letters free of charge in the Arcade of the Scribes, the friends of Florentino Arisa's youth were certain that they were slowly losing him beyond recall. And they were right. When he returned from his voyage along the river, he still saw some of them in the hope of dimming the memory of Fermina Daza. He played billiards with them, he went to their dances, he allowed himself to be raffled off among the girls. He allowed himself to do everything he thought would help him to become the man he had once been. Later, when Uncle Leo XII took him on as an employee, he played dominoes with his office mates in the commercial club, and they began to accept him as one of their own when he spoke to them of nothing but the navigation company, which he did not call by its complete name but by its initials, the RCC. He even changed the way he ate. As indifferent and irregular as he had been until then regarding food, that was how habitual and austere he became until the end of his days. A large cup of black coffee for breakfast, a slice of poached fish with white rice for lunch, a cup of café con leche and a piece of cheese before going to bed. He drank black coffee at any hour, anywhere, under any circumstances, as many as 30 little cups a day. A brew like crude oil, which he preferred to prepare himself, and which he always kept near at hand in a thermos. He was another person. Despite his firm decision and anguished efforts to continue to be the same man he had been before his mortal encounter with love. The truth is that he was never the same again. Winning back Fermina Daza was the sole purpose of his life, and he was so certain of achieving it sooner or later that he convinced Tránsito Arisa to continue with the restoration of the house so that it would be ready to receive her whenever the miracle took place. In contrast to her reaction to the proposed publication of The Lover's Companion, Tránsito Arisa went much further. She bought the house at once and undertook a complete renovation. They made a reception room where the bedroom had been. On the upper floor, they built two spacious, bright bedrooms, one for the married couple and another for the children they were going to have. And in the space where the old tobacco factory had been, they put in an extensive garden with all kinds of roses, which Florentino Arisa himself tended during his free time at dawn. The only thing they left intact, as a kind of testimony of gratitude to the past, was the notion shop. The back room, where Florentino Arisa had slept, they left as it had always been, with the hammock hanging and the writing table covered with untidy piles of books. But he moved to the room planned as the conjugal bedroom on the upper floor. This was the largest and airiest in the house, and it had an interior terrace where it was pleasant to sit at night because of the sea breeze and the scent of the rose bushes. But it was also the room that best reflected Florentino Arisa's Trappist severity. The plain whitewashed walls were rough and unadorned, and the only furniture was a prison cot, a night table with a candle in a bottle, an old wardrobe, and a washstand with its basin and bowl. The work took almost 3 years, and it coincided with a brief civic revival owing to the boom in river navigation and trade, the same factors that had maintained the city's greatness during colonial times and for more than two centuries had made her the gateway to America. But that was also the period when Tránsito Arisa manifested the first symptoms of her incurable disease. Her regular clients were older, paler, and more faded each time they came to the notion shop, and she did not recognize them after dealing with them for half a lifetime, or she confused the affairs of one with those of another, which was a very grave matter in a business like hers, in which no papers were signed to protect her honor or theirs, and one's word of honor was given and accepted as sufficient guarantee. At first it seemed she was growing deaf, but it soon became evident that her memory was trickling away. And so she liquidated her pawn business. The treasure in the jars paid for completing and furnishing the house, and still left over were many of the most valuable old jewels in the city, whose owners did not have funds to redeem them. During this period, Florentino Arisa had to attend to too many responsibilities at the same time, but his spirits never flagged as he sought to expand his work as a furtive hunter. After his erratic experience with the widow Nazareth, which opened the door to street love, he continued to hunt the abandoned little birds of the night for several years, still hoping to find a cure for the pain of Fermina Daza. But by then he could no longer tell if his habit of fornicating without hope was a mental necessity or a simple vice of the body. His visits to the transient hotel became less frequent, not only because his interests lay elsewhere, but because he did not like them to see him there under circumstances that were different from the chaste domesticity of the past. Nevertheless, in three emergency situations, he had recourse to the simple strategy of an era before his time. He disguised his friends, who were afraid of being recognized, as men, and they walked into the hotel together as if they were two gentlemen out on the town. Yet on two of these occasions, someone realized that he and his presumptive male companion did not go to the bar, but to a room, and the already tarnished reputation of Florentino Arisa received the coup de grâce. At last he stopped going there, except for the very few times he did so, not to catch up on what he had missed, but for just the opposite reason, to find a refuge where he could recuperate from his excesses. And it was just as well. No sooner did he leave his office at 5 in the afternoon than he began to hunt like a chicken hawk. At first he was content with what the night provided. He picked up serving girls in the parks, black women in the market, sophisticated young ladies from the interior on the beaches, gringas on the boats from New Orleans. He took them to the jetties where half the city also went after nightfall. He took them wherever he could, and sometimes even where he could not. And not infrequently he had to hurry into a dark entryway and do what he could, however he could do it, behind the gate. The lighthouse was always a blessed refuge in a storm, which he evoked with nostalgia in the dawn of his old age when he had everything settled, because it was a good place to be happy, above all at night, and he thought that something of his loves from that time flashed out to the sailors with every turn of the light. So that he continued to go there more than to any other spot, while his friend the lighthouse keeper was delighted to receive him with a simple-minded expression on his face that was the best guarantee of discretion for the frightened little birds. There was a house at the foot of the tower, close to the thunder of the waves breaking against the cliffs, where love was more intense because it seemed like a shipwreck. But Florentino Arisa preferred the light tower itself, late at night, because one could see the entire city and the trail of lights on the fishing boats at sea, and even in the distant swamps. It was in those days that he devised his rather simplistic theories concerning the relationship between a woman's appearance and her aptitude for love. He distrusted the sensual type, the ones who looked as if they could eat an alligator raw and tended to be the most passive in bed. The type he preferred was just the opposite. Those skinny little tadpoles that no one bothered to turn around and look at in the street, who seemed to disappear when they took off their clothes, who made you feel sorry for them when their bones cracked at the first impact, and yet who could leave the man who bragged the most about his virility ready for the trash can. He had made notes of these premature observations, intending to write a practical supplement to the Lover's Companion. But the project met the same fate as the previous one, after Ausencia Santander sent him tumbling with her old dog's wisdom, stood him on his head, tossed him up and threw him down, made him as good as new, shattered all his virtuous theories, and taught him the only thing he had to learn about love, that nobody teaches life anything. Ausencia Santander had had a conventional marriage for 20 years, which left her with 3 children who had married and had children in turn, so that she boasted of being the grandmother with the best bed in the city. It was never clear if she had abandoned her husband or if he had abandoned her, or if they had abandoned each other at the same time. But he went to live with his regular mistress, and then she felt free, in the middle of the day and at the front door, to receive Rosendo de la Rosa, a riverboat captain, whom she had often received in the middle of the night at the back door. Without giving the matter a second thought, he brought Florentino Arisa to meet her. He brought him for lunch. He also brought a demijohn of homemade aguardiente and ingredients of the highest quality for an epic sancocho, the kind that was possible only with chickens from the patio, meat with tender bones, rubbish heap pork, and greens and vegetables from the towns along the river. Nevertheless, from the very first, Florentino Arisa was not as enthusiastic about the excellence of the cuisine or the exuberance of the lady of the house as he was about the beauty of the house itself. He liked her because of her house, bright and cool, with 4 large windows facing the sea, and beyond that, a complete view of the old city. He liked the quantity and the splendor of the things that gave the living room a confused and at the same time rigorous appearance, with all kinds of handcrafted objects that Captain Rosendo de la Rosa brought back from each trip until there was no room left for another piece. On the sea terrace, sitting on his private ring, was a cockatoo from Malaya, with unbelievable white plumage and a pensive tranquility that gave one much to think about. It was the most beautiful animal that Florentino Arisa had ever seen. Captain Rosendo de la Rosa was enthusiastic about his guest's enthusiasm, and he told him in detail the history of each object. As he spoke, he sipped aguardiente without pause. He seemed to be made of reinforced concrete. He was enormous, with hair all over his body except on his head, a mustache like a house painter's brush, a voice like a capstan, which would have been his alone, and an exquisite courtesy. But not even his body could resist the way he drank. Before they sat down to the table, he had finished half of the demijohn, and he fell forward onto the tray of glasses and bottles with a slow sound of demolition. Ausencia Santander had to ask Florentino Arisa to help her drag the inert body of the beached whale to bed and undress him as he slept. Then, in a flash of inspiration that they attributed to a conjunction of their stars, the two of them undressed in the next room without agreeing to, without even suggesting it or proposing it to each other, and for more than 7 years they continued undressing wherever they could while the captain was on a trip. There was no danger of his surprising them, because he had the good sailor's habit of advising the port of his arrival by sounding the ship's horn, even at dawn, first with 3 long howls for his wife and 9 children, and then with 2 short, melancholy ones for his mistress. Ausencia Santander was almost 50 years old and looked it, but she had such a personal instinct for love that no homegrown or scientific theories could interfere with it. Florentino Arisa knew from the ship's itineraries when he could visit her, and he always went unannounced, whenever he wanted to, at any hour of the day or night, and never once was she not waiting for him. She would open the door as her mother had raised her until she was 7 years old, stark naked, with an organdy ribbon in her hair. She would not let him take another step until she had undressed him, because she thought it was bad luck to have a clothed man in the house. This was the cause of constant discord with Captain Rosendo de la Rosa, because he had the superstitious belief that smoking naked brought bad luck, and at times he preferred to put off love rather than put out his inevitable Cuban cigar. On the other hand, Florentino Arisa was very taken with the charms of nudity, and she removed his clothes with sure delight as soon as she closed the door, not even giving him time to greet her or to take off his hat or his glasses, kissing him and letting him kiss her with sharp-toothed kisses, unfastening his clothes from bottom to top, First, the buttons of his fly, one by one after each kiss, then his belt buckle, and at the last, his vest and shirt, until he was like a live fish that had been split open from head to tail. Then she sat him in the living room and took off his boots, pulled on his trouser cuffs, so that she could take off his pants while she removed his long underwear, and at last she undid the garters around his calves and took off his socks. Then Florentino Arisa stopped kissing her and letting her kiss him, so that he could do the only thing he was responsible for in that precise ceremony. He took his watch and chain out of the buttonhole in his vest, and took off his glasses, and put them in his boots so he would be sure not to forget them. He always took that precaution, always, without fail, whenever he undressed in someone else's house. As soon as he had done that, she attacked him without giving him time for anything else, there on the same sofa where she had just undressed him, and only on rare occasions in the bed. She mounted him and took control of all of him for all of her, absorbed in herself, her eyes closed, gauging the situation in her absolute inner darkness, advancing here, retreating there, correcting her invisible route, trying another more intense path, another means of proceeding without drowning in the slimy marsh that flowed from her womb. Droning like a horsefly as she asked herself questions and answered in her native jargon. Where was that something in the shadows that only she knew about and that she longed for just for herself, until she succumbed without waiting for anybody? She fell alone into her abyss with a jubilant explosion of total victory that made the world tremble. Florentino Arisa was left exhausted, incomplete, floating in a puddle of their perspiration, but with the impression of being no more than an instrument of pleasure. He would say, "You treat me as if I were just anybody." She would roar with the laughter of a free female and say, "Not at all. As if you were nobody." He was left with the impression that she took away everything with mean-spirited greed, and his pride